I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome to Radio Times. Here are some sobering statistics. Suicide is on the rise and is the second leading cause of death for young people aged 10 to 24. That's according to the CDC. For high schoolers, almost 20% said they had thought about suicide and almost 10% said they had made an attempt. The Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, based on a young adult novel, is about a high school girl named Hannah who kills herself after being raped and cyberbullied. She records and sends tapes to the classmates and adults she says are responsible for her death. This is not the first time teen suicide has been portrayed on TV, but the series has created controversy. Some have praised its realistic, even graphic portrayal of such a difficult subject, while others worry that it sensationalizes suicide and could lead to copycats. Netflix has added warnings to the series and just decided there will be a second season. We're going to talk about how to recognize kids at risk, what interventions work, and the challenges of talking about suicide without influencing vulnerable, adolescents to take their lives. And we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Guy Diamond is chair of the Center for Family Intervention Science in the College of Nursing and Health Professions at Drexel University. He's also the primary developer of attachment-based family therapy and intervention for suicidal youth. And Guy Diamond, nice to have you with us on
Thanks
Radio Times.
For having me,
You're very welcome. Carolina Hausman-Stabile is assistant professor in the School of Social Work in the College of Public Health at Temple University. She studies suicidal behaviors among minority youth in the United States and in Latin America. And Carolina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for the invitation.
You're welcome. And to round out our trio of guests, we have Matthew Winterstein with us here in our Philadelphia studio, associate professor, director of research in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the Sidney Kimmelman Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. He's co-chair of the Pennsylvania Youth Suicide Prevention Initiative, also director of the Pennsylvania Higher Education Suicide Prevention Coalition. Matthew, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let me begin with you, Matthew. What's the message that you take away, or the messages that you took away from this series?
Well, it's a great question. I think that there are a lot of things that come out of it. As a healthcare professional, I look at it and I think, it does have a lot of sensational views of things that, may be actual things that are actually happening in schools. But the problem is that the kids are binge watching this. They're getting a lot of very highly sensitive information all happening at one time, and it's difficult to process it. And, my concern is that they are not processing it very well, and some highly vulnerable kids are viewing it, and it could be upsetting.
How about for you, Caroline? As you watched the series, what were some of the messages you saw?
I thought that it was an opportunity to have a responsible and scientifically informed discussion that could help vulnerable kids and also could bring conversations to families and to schools.
So the idea as a kind of a conversation starter.
Correct.
And from your perspective, Guy?
Yeah, I would say it's a mixed bag. It has raised the conversation in a way that my community prevention efforts often don't, and using media in that way has brought me here to your table. And I don't get invited here enough. So in that way, there's some really good things, and kids I know and kids on the internet are talking about this, talking about bullying, talking about being nicer to people, sort of seeing some awareness about what it means about kids who get picked on. But I think, as Matt says, the more vulnerable kids, the kids who are, depressed, at risk, having life struggles, they see a film like this and think, oh, maybe suicide's I would be remembered, and maybe I should use it as a revenge strategy. And so there's definitely, from the professional community, some concerns about the show.
But it's interesting to think about the professional community. You all represent that, but also thinking about young people who are watching this. My understanding, it's the most watched of the Netflix series. Kids are talking about it. I mean, it seems to me, Matthew, they are telling us something. They are telling us that they're probably telling us many different things as teenagers are wont to do, but they're telling us something.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what that is, unfortunately, at the moment, because what I know is that kids get drawn into this. I think it was produced in such a way that's very captivating. If I were 15 or 16 years old, I would go straight in and I'd be watching it. And the problem is, you know, I would end up seeing some things that I didn't know I was going to see, and I'm not sure I would have wanted to see. And what do I do with that information afterwards is really the question. And, you know, I think Carolina raised a really important point, which is that it's a great opportunity to have a conversation, but that's just not happening. If you look at the 47 plus million viewers of this, most of them are kids and their parents are not watching this, and there is no conversation happening.
I mean, you say the parents... But I watched not all of it, but some of it, and I was thinking, I mean, if I were a depressed 15-year-old girl, I would, you know, I'd want my parent there, perhaps, or I would be upset if I saw this by myself.
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, you know, certainly kids that have struggled in some way may want somebody else with them. But the reality is, and Guy can speak to this probably better than any of us here, is that they don't always know how to communicate that need and that desire. And parents, you know, for all the wonderful things that we offer our children, we sometimes don't know how to communicate back to them about this. And so a parent might watch this and say, I don't know what to do with this information and not even know where to start the conversation.
In fact, Guy, I would say, sort of broadly speaking, the adults in this come across as kind of clueless. You know, they don't really know what's going on in these kids' life. You do see scenes of their parents saying, how are you feeling? And the kid says, I'm fine, I'm fine. But speak to us about family involvement.
Well, there's a lot to say about family involvement, but I think you're right. In the show, you know, they portray parents who are more out of touch than a lot of parents. I think a lot of parents do track their kids and are close to their kids. And really the norm of adolescent development is kids are close to their parents, can go to them when they're feeling stressed or in trouble. And the kids that can't do that are the ones who are more in the zone of I'm isolated, I'm lonely, I don't have anyone to go to. So whether they portray the best parents, you know, or the whole range of parents is a good question. I think in general, you know, and I think what we would hope is the next season would take a more socially responsible role. And the producers would say, this has made an impact. How could we now use this to educate, not just to scare or intimidate or sensationalize? And there's really a lot of, you know, they could have post shows, they could have commentary, they could have, I mean, Netflix could really become a social activist around something like this if they chose to do something like that.
There is a scene, it's a very graphic scene where Hannah is in the bathtub and she slits her wrist. I watched it. I cringed. It was so difficult. They did consult some psychologists, one of whom said about this scene, it has to be really painful and ugly and sad, really show the waste and the pain that it brings and the anguish to her parents especially. It seemed that the filmmakers, Carolina, wanted people to see what a teenager killing herself looks like. The camera does not flinch.
It's interesting that with that intent, they chose a method that is hardly used in death by suicide among teenagers and in the general population. So we know that first, adolescents that attempt suicide tend to use means that are available in the house because most attempts are impulsive. So they might use knives. In Hannah's case, she prepares herself to cut, getting the razors ahead of time. And we also know that for most girls, pills and superficial cutting is the most common method of attempting. For boys, it's guns. So the method doesn't really match, but we know that it's happening in this population, but it's very dramatic.
Is there... How do you see that scene, or how do you experience that, or imagine a teenager experiencing that?
You know, it's interesting. So full disclosure, so this has been out for like 5 weeks.
It has.
And Guy and I were in the middle of writing a grant at the time when it came out, so it took me a week to start watching it. But then I watched all of it except the last episode until last night, because I felt like I need to watch the last episode before I can come and talk with you about it. I'd heard about it. I knew what was going to happen. And I think the reality is, much like a couple of the other episodes, there were things that happened in them that you could understand as having happened without actually having to see it. And so I think they probably went too far. I think you could have actually skipped the actual cutting behavior. I think, you know, Kate Walsh as an actress in this was actually brilliant.
She plays Hannah.
Yeah. She was the mother.
Oh, the mother. Yes.
Yeah.
The mother.
She was brilliant. I mean, from that kind of perspective. And I think you still could have gotten the response from her, and you still could have gotten the family, like how they felt about this without actually seeing what happened, which is where, you know, I think they took it a little bit too far at that point.
I mean, do you think Guy showing it in such graphic detail, I mean, the camera does not flinch, was irresponsible? Can we know?
You know, this is media. That you know, they don't, I don't think they always have this. You know, we see violence on TV, we see sex on TV, we see horrific things, and I think the media is trying to sell things more than trying to be socially accountable to society.
Even if they brought in psychologists and wanted to...
It violates every single one of the responsible media reporting on suicide. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, go ahead, Matthew.
Well, it's you know, even as we're talking here, talking about methods is not necessarily the most helpful way of having these conversations. And the truth is, showing this is even worse. And there is a subset of youth out there that probably skipped straight to the last episode because they heard that's the one where she dies and wanted to just watch that because it's there and it's available to them. And I think that that's unfortunate. And like I said, I think there's different ways of doing it. And we know, you know, there's media guidelines on how to talk about suicide. And certainly one of them is to not talk about the details and the methods and going into the nitty gritty of it. And so showing it, of course, is taking it a whole step beyond that.
So guys, a teenage girl will say, watching this scene, who feels isolated, alone, perhaps depressed, is going to look at it and say,
Yeah, those more vulnerable kids that we work with all the time see this and feel confirmation, feel like this is a legitimate solution to the pain I feel. And that's the real, you know, disservice of the show, that's the message of the ultimate, that this is a permissible, okay, and in fact, since, you know, memorialized experience afterward, your voice lives on, people think about you. We decorate your locker. It's one of the few things that you're not supposed to do. And so in that way, we worry about the kids we see who think this and say, Guy, you told me this isn't a good thing, but look how important it was to this community.
That's interesting. Let me read something that the writer, Nick Sheff, said. Apparently he had some problems with suicidal thoughts and perhaps even actions, but he said, it seemed to me the perfect opportunity to show what an actual suicide looks like, to dispel the myth of the quiet drifting off and to make viewers face the reality of what happens when you jump from a burning building into something much, much worse. Carolina?
You know, in a way, the show misses to portray the pain that somebody who decides to attempt to their life goes through in that moment. And the gruesomeness of the images portrayed, really, I wonder if they are for emotional effect in the audience more than for educating and more than triggering these conversations that are healthy.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Carolina Hausman-Stabile, also with us, Guy Diamond, and Matthew Winterstein. We are talking about the Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, based on the best-selling young adult novel about a girl who commits suicide after being raped and bullied. It has generated a huge conversation and some controversy as well. You can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with my guests about how to talk to young people, especially teenagers, about depression, about thoughts of suicide. And again, let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. Matthew Winterstein is a director of research in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Thomas Jefferson University, co-chair of the Pennsylvania Youth Suicide Prevention Initiative. Carolina Hausman-Stabile, assistant professor in the School of Social Work at Temple University, studies suicidal behaviors among minority youth in the U.S., also in Latin America. And Guy Diamond, chair of the Center for Family Intervention Science at Drexel University, the primary developer of attachment-based family therapy and intervention for suicidal youth. You can also join our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments? We're certainly talking about this Netflix series, but also talking about what we need to know to deal with young people who might be feeling very insecure and unhappy about their lives. Let me segue then to real life. And perhaps, Matthew, I'll go to you. How do we recognize serious depression, even thoughts of suicide in a teenage boy or girl?
Yeah, no, that's really important. And I think before I kind of jump into what are the warning signs, I think it's also important to sort of separate depression from suicide risk, because as much as some kids who are depressed may be suicidal, you don't necessarily have to be depressed to be suicidal. And some people who are suicidal are not depressed. It seems counterintuitive, but the data supports that. Warning signs, I think, are critically important because it sort of tells us what might be happening in the days, moments, up to a week or so before somebody makes a life-threatening suicide attempt. And we've done a lot of really good work around this. And so an expert consensus panel came together, and we have what we think are probably those warning signs, although every kid's a little bit unique and different.
Sure.
So the first is obviously any kid who's talking about suicide, any kid who is writing about it, talking about it, sharing information with others, sometimes on social media, but whenever they're doing those kinds of things, you know, and certainly in, you know, 13 Reasons Why, in this very last episode, she comes to the guidance counselor and could have been wearing a t-shirt that said, "I'm thinking about killing myself," and he missed it.
Yes.
So you have that. So suicidal talk and behavior. Second is a sense of helplessness. And so this is not just like things are not going to get any better. We have to recognize that people who are suicidal do not want that to be their experience. They do many things to try to make things better, and often find that they're hitting hurdles again and again and again, and they can't get over them. So it's this sense of helplessness that sort of perpetuates over time. The third is a sense of overwhelming emotional pain. And so it's this experience that oftentimes can't be described. And fortunately, we've had the privilege of talking to several people about this, and they often describe it as sort of the kid who might look like they're angry, frustrated, and sad all at the same time. So it's a really mixed bag, where you might be looking angry but tearful at the same time. So it's overwhelming emotional pain. And the last is sort of a cluster of behaviors. And so those things range from being withdrawn from other people. And it doesn't have to be withdrawn from everything. It's just the things that they're typically involved in, it's like they're just not there. Some of it's lack of social connection. And you see this in the show, too, where, you know, one text message suddenly ostracizes one person from everybody else. And so it's those kinds of things. It's agitation, irritability that are out of character, out of context for that person. And the last major difference that sometimes parents see but don't recognize it as such is sleep problems. And so, again, this is sort of classic symptom of depression, but either too much or too little sleep. And it's not because they're up watching Netflix. It's because they have been in bed since a reasonable hour and are just trying to sort through problems in their head, and they're ruminating and they can't solve them and figure them out. And so they don't fall asleep until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. They get up at 6:30 to go to school. They're falling asleep in class, and nobody has the forethought. I shouldn't say nobody. Some teachers are very good at this, but not all of them have the forethought to say, "Hey, is everything okay?"
That's all very helpful. Carolina, let me turn to you. You study suicide behaviors among minority youth in the U.S. Anything you want to add to what Matthew said? Is it different for minority kids in this country?
It's exacerbated in terms of conflicts in the family. So because minority families, specifically among Latinos, we have such expectation about cohesiveness and love and peacefulness in the relationship that any violation of those through normal adolescent conflicts, what parent in America cannot recognize parenting an adolescent is challenging,
yes,
and comes with a lot of conflicts. But the conflicts are exacerbated. And we see periods of increasing conflicts between adolescent girls who have very high rates of suicidal behaviors and their moms primary. And these conflicts tend to be around issues of autonomy and independence. So the girl wants to do something with her friends. She wants to decide what to wear to school. And mom is trying to impose some rules that make complete sense for mom. So in this tug of war, they're fighting and fighting, and it's escalating. And also the conflicts don't have a resolution. Both parties are angry at each other, but they cannot meet at a middle ground. Mm. And we see that exacerbating. And what happens in Latina girls specifically is that there is this period of increased conflict leads to a big argument, where people say nasty things to each other, where they're very angry, and where the girl feels that her family distress is caused by her behavior. And if she's removed from the picture, the family will have the peace they deserve. So she decides to take her life.
Wow. I mean, that's a very dramatic and sobering description of what can happen in a family. Hold on to that, Carolina, because I want to move on to you, Guy. I'm interested in this sort of attachment-based family therapy. So based on what our other two guests said about, especially with adults, either parents or friends of parents or teachers, what is the best way to react if a young person comes and says, I'm feeling really down, I'm thinking about things like suicide?
Yeah.
What do you say?
So it's a big question. There's a whole range of things. I mean, I would start with what Uzo just said, that we view the family as the secure base of child development, and it's really in the family relationships that kids learn how to problem solve, regulate their emotions, feel safe in the world, feel like there's people I can trust and turn to. And if you grow up in that kind of environment, you internalize those kinds of skills and you continue to rely on your parents and you start to look for peers that you can do that with and reach out to parents, other adults. So it's the family sort of sets the foundation for those kind of internal coping skills.
But if the family can't do that or isn't doing that, what happens?
When the family can't do that, kids tend to develop more dysregulated strategies for relationships or guarding themselves against hurt or impulsiveness. And it's from our point of view as a family therapist, we see a lot of these kids. They come to us after hospital and they come to us from the emergency room. And our job is to sort of recalibrate and kind of help parents recover some of their more effective parenting strategies and help kids start to try once again to trust their parents. Maybe I can turn to them for help and comfort.
So if a let's say, 15, 16-year-old girl or boy turns to their parents and says, you know, I've been thinking about suicide, to use what you said, Matthew, what should a parent say? I hear you.
In those moments, parents need to take the comment seriously. They need to stop what they're doing. They need to sit down with this child and say, I didn't know you were feeling this way. Tell me more about this. How can we help you? You know, when did this start? Become curious, become more interested. Give the kid space. A lot of parents, unfortunately, see this as manipulation, or you know, they're just seeking attention. These
or
kinds
they don't
of
want
things.
To talk, or it makes the parent feel uncomfortable,
right.
And scared.
Right.
It creates
a lot of anxiety, I think, in parents too, because they, you know, one, they don't want this to be true. So either they inadvertently minimize it and think, you know, don't worry about it, everything's going to be okay, which of course the kid sees as you didn't hear a word that I just said to you. Or as a parent, you get very anxious about it, you're not quite sure what to do, and parents often solve problems with their mouth as opposed to using their ears. And so back to Guy's point, it's absolutely right. It's tell me more, like, you know, I'm curious what, you know, what do we need to do? Like, let's, what's that been like for you? Let's talk about it instead of saying, do this, do that, let's fix this, let's fix that, because that often doesn't resonate for the kids. They don't necessarily need somebody to fix it that way. They need somebody to listen first and then collaboratively work together to get it better.
And that particularly maps on to adolescence, where autonomy is becoming a more important issue. And they're not five anymore. They're, you know, 15. They have a mind of their own. And if you don't incorporate them into the conversation, ask their opinion, get them involved, these kinds of negotiations become much more conflictual. So it's very critical at that point.
Absolutely. Let me read a text from Mark. He says, my 12-year-old niece has spoken of harming herself and has shut herself off from most of the members of the family. I'm at a loss in terms of action, but I know one thing. I do not want her to watch this program. But I guess, I mean, that's fine. I'm not sure how much control as the uncle he has over that. And for all we know, she might have watched it already. But again, I guess, Caroline, it's sort of a variation of what we were just talking about, which is what, you know, what do you do? And perhaps what do you do when that's not your child, it's your niece?
You hear. You pay attention. You give space. You ask questions that would lead to conversation, to dialogue, like we are doing here. Also, we have to help parents and help children to ask for help. Most adolescents don't tell their parents that they are suicidal. They tell their peers who freak out and tell their teachers. And now we know that, for instance, a lot of children, minority children who are suicidal, tell peers in libraries and they run to tell the librarian. So we have to educate the large community that deals with adolescents and with children to know how to answer to that. And the main response for me will be we need to get help. When a child is asking for help, we need to look for professional help.
I was reading about a girl who posted something on 17.com. This was, you know, girls' reactions to 13 Reasons Why. She says it's reality, and the people that don't like it are super clueless to what high school and middle schools are about. I mean, this is, again, a young person saying, you don't know the half of it. Mm-hmm. Let me get Suzanne from Delaware to join our conversation. And Suzanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And just listening to the show sparked me to think that last year my 17-year-old nephew took his life with a poisonous gas. Oh. It's called detergent suicide, and he found the recipe online easily. And afterwards, when the police looked over his phone and his computer, they found that he'd been to the site numerous times. Mm. And he had purchased the ingredients easily, put them in a bucket one night after everybody went to bed, and that was it. In the morning, he was in the car, and, you know, there was a lot of signs that he was very depressed and suicidal. However, his parents didn't really take it that seriously, and maybe not just the parents, but the, you know, aunts, uncles, cousins could have been more helpful.
Well, Suzanne, that is such a sad story, and I really appreciate you calling in because it really underscores what we're talking about. And even the person who texted us, this was a concerned uncle. Do you want to respond, Matthew, just to Suzanne's story there?
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you sharing that. I know that's not easy to talk about. I think that's the, you know, hindsight's 20/20. And I think the biggest challenge that we always have with suicide, particularly as a loved one who may have lost somebody to suicide, is the why question and understanding those kinds of things. And it's easy, I think, as peers, family members, et cetera, when somebody has died, to wonder what is it that I could have done differently, which interestingly is the twist that the show. I think the real story in the show is that if people can take some view, internal view of their own experience and kind of how what they do doesn't dictate what other people are going to do, but how it impacts other people, I think that's really important. But yeah. It's difficult.
In fact, Hannah, the girl who commits suicide, her friend Clay says, I believe it's in the last episode, he says it has to get better the way we treat each other and look out for each other. It has to get better somehow. I mean, this is sort of putting it back on the kids, I guess, to sort of figure out what to do the next time.
Yeah, right? I mean, this has been my, you know, the little information I've been able to gather from kids who are not vulnerable, depressed, you know, who are going to take these messages negatively, but the average kid in high school, you know, is talking about that. Yeah. Oh, my God, this really brings home how nasty high school can be and how mean we can be, and we need to try to be better to each other. And so I think there is some awareness of that, that this show has stimulated that other shows about bullying have not. And the question is, can it become an opportunity? Can we capitalize on that and have a more – proactive educational experience out of the show?
Well, I'm thinking about Romeo and Juliet, which is certainly about lovers and a suicide, but also there have been, Carolina, other TV shows that have dealt with suicide, some very popular shows. I think not in this long series that you could actually binge watch if you wanted to do. Is there something about the intensity of watching now and perhaps the graphic nature of 13 Reasons Why that has gotten people kind of riled up?
I think it touches upon several things. One, it touches very close to the experience of kids in high school. When you started the show today, you talk about 20% of adolescents are thinking of dying by suicide in high school. That's
Shocking.
One-fifth of kids. And they are observing their peers cutting themselves. They are seeing their friends depressed. This is an everyday experience for children in schools in the U.S. And more so for children who are not in school. Kids that are homeless, kids that have been trafficked, kids that are extremely vulnerable have higher rates than kids that are in school. Because their experience of everyday struggle is much greater. And we know that kids who attempt suicide in general report a lot of struggle and trauma.
And trauma as well. That true, Matthew?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I still think back 10 years ago, Guy and I were working on an attachment-based family therapy study, and we were just getting just blown away by the number of kids that were coming in into this study with suicidal thoughts, but their trauma experiences, not necessarily related to one event, but to a series of experiences. It might have been just their community as a whole, but it was just overwhelming.
Yeah. I mean, Guy, you started by talking about the fact that for a number of kids, they have good relationships with their parents. They turn to their parents. I mean, that's one picture of adolescence.
Right. And that is the norm, really. The stress and struggle, the conflict is really more indicative of families that have always had problems where there's always been disorganization or chaos. And so that is what we try to recapture right. with these families. I think both the comments were right and worth saying, you know, for us, when we see suicidal kids, it's often that bad things have happened. This isn't some internal disease and my mind doesn't work well. And these are kids who've been traumatized, bullied. We work with a lot of gay and lesbian kids who are having all kinds of social stressors with that. We work with families with chaos where there's marital conflict and alcoholism and depressed parents, and that for most kids there's trauma and it's bad things have happened and no one's helping me cope with that or taking it seriously or understanding how it's impacting me. And, you know, that's really our approach to trying to work with these kids.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about several different things, certainly the controversial Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, which has raised this question about suicide and how to deal with young people who have suicidal thoughts. Perhaps some who have even attempted suicide. The voice you just heard, Guy Diamond, chair of the Center for Family Intervention Science at Drexel University. Carolina Hausman-Stabile, assistant professor at the School of Social Work at Temple University. And Matthew Winterstein, he's co-chair of the Pennsylvania Youth Suicide Prevention Initiative, also director of research at Thomas Jefferson University. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with our guests about how to recognize kids at risk for suicide, what interventions work, the challenges of talking about suicide without influencing vulnerable adolescents to take their lives. And you can join our conversation. Call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me play just a small clip. This is Selena Gomez, one of the producers of 13 Reasons Why. She's discussing why she wanted to produce a television series based on the book 13 Reasons Why. And I should add a part of this discussion. She did say that she had been hospitalized for 3 months.
It hits a very important part in me. And I think this is what they need to see. Like, we're not going to post things that are like, hey, be empowered, because that's not what they want to see. Unfortunately, kids don't care. They don't care. They have to see something that's going to shake them. They have to see something that's frightening and follow these people who are, they're going to instantly fall in love with these characters. I want them to understand it. I would do anything to be able to have a good influence on this generation, and it's hard, but I definitely relate to everything that was going on, and I was there for the last episode, and I was a mess just seeing it all come to life because I've experienced just that.
Matthew, she talks about shaking them, frightening them. I mean, I think what she's saying is that she wanted to scare kids away from thinking about suicide. Is that an effective approach?
No. I'm not sure scaring them away from thinking about suicide is really the way to think about this. I think that she, you know, if anything good is coming from it, yeah, we're having a conversation about this. And, you know, hopefully there's plenty of adults that are listening that are hearing about this who may consider going to watch it because their kids may have seen it. They just don't know their kids have seen it. But scaring somebody...
It's like Scared Straight. Remember,
yeah, it doesn't work either.
Keep kids out of prison.
But I think there's, you know, what she's trying, maybe what she's fighting against is really the stigma about mental health in our society. And she's sort of probably fighting against the people who ignored her, who didn't take her seriously, and others, and, you know, and saying we need to shake up this community. People need to take this seriously. It's a real problem, and we can't just pretend these aren't issues. And I think there are all kinds of risks that go along with her strategy, but my guess is that's what she's fighting against, the denial.
Carolina, you want to add something? Go ahead.
Yes, and fear is never something that leads to thinking.
Fear doesn't lead to thinking.
No, we are paralyzed or we run away. And to discuss issues like the serious behaviors, we need to sit down calmly and talk about difficult things. So scaring and touching emotions and the way she presented, it's valid artistically, but I don't think it's a good way to prevent more kids from engaging in these behaviors.
Is there something wrong also with, in a sense, Hannah, the girl, blaming others? I mean, in a certain way, she makes the tapes and she gives them to all the people that she thinks are in part responsible for her taking her life. Is there, how do I say this, something irresponsible on her side?
But they keep referring to it as a revenge suicide.
Yeah.
And frankly, in the kids we work with, that's actually a very little motivation for these kids. We ask them, why do you, and that is not what kids naturally come forward with. They come forward with, I'm in pain, I feel trapped, I can't get out of this, I don't know how to do this, I'm isolated. And so I don't know if you had much revenge suicides.
Yeah, you're shaking your head, Carolina. No,
in general, we know that adults report fantasies of, you know, survivors of attempts report fantasies of wanting to hurt somebody. Or watching, and among Latina girls, they tell us that they're watching their family and their funeral, all crying and feeling remorseful for what they have done to them, pushing them so into pain. But it's not a big motivator.
In fact, I got the feeling, Matthew, the way you talked is that for, and we're talking about young people here, they feel as if people will be better off without them.
Most feel like they're a burden on other people.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much I'm trying to get back at you. I mean, you have to think about sort of the rational or the irrational thought that would have to be behind that. But it's typically about they feel like they're a burden on somebody else, that they, whatever's going on for them is too much for anybody else to handle. And nobody can manage that. And interestingly, that I think that actually plays out fairly well in the character in the series, but it doesn't get stated that way. And this method of sort of implicating everybody, you know, has real negative effects, as you can see just in the last episode.
Sure.
You know, here we are sort of speculating about what would happen in the second season. They could do something really good with this, but the good that they could do with it is not going to sell subscriptions to Netflix.
Oh, you think not? Just, I mean, if they kind of tamp it down a bit, it's...
Well, they could take this and say, let's talk about postvention. How do we manage these kinds of things? How do we work with people that are struggling? And how do we bring a school back together after these horrific series of events that have happened? The problem is that's not going to sell.
Hmm.
It's not.
Let me get...
I think there could be ways to... I mean, I think there is trauma. There's rape.
Right.
That never got dealt with. I mean, I think, you know, and from, I think, all of us take a therapeutic approach that these traumas need to get on the table,
right,
and let's talk about these things and work through them. That could be a pretty exciting thing to. I'm always curious why there's not more therapy TV shows. You know, there's plenty of drama goes
spoken
on.
Spoken like a real therapist. The therapy, yes, right. I understand.
I
hear you. Let me get, looks like Clara to join our conversation. And Clara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You did touch on what I was going to mention, which was the revenge type of angle. But I wanted to also add to that, there was one of the characters who I feel was, you know, if you want to talk about responsibility, one of the least responsible. I think his name was Alex, the blonde boy, who in the end shot himself in the head because he couldn't deal with the guilt of it. And I think that that's an outcome that we should all be talking about, because, you know, if she was trying to do it to make people feel bad or to feel as bad as she did, she succeeded. And here is another child who tried to take his own life, which I think definitely needs to be talked about, the kind of repercussions that could be that
sure.
deadly.
No, I think that's actually a terrific point, Clara. And I know our guests want to respond. Go ahead, Matthew.
I mean, it speaks to the whole issue of contagion. You know, when somebody dies by suicide, other people that are close to them who also have been thinking about suicide in the past become more vulnerable. And the reality with this model, in terms of how this, then the plot line sort of falls out, is that you've got a character who dies by suicide, implicates several other people. And the argument is that every single one of those kids on those tapes at that moment is significantly higher risk for suicide. One of them we know attempts to take his own life. Another one we think either was going to or might be heading out to go do so. And it's hard to say what's going to happen here. And the thing that's missed in all of this, you know, again, I didn't write the book. So the thing that's missed in all of this is, had she been able to talk with these kids about the experience, or talk to an adult who could intervene or could talk with her about this experience and what was going on with her, these tapes wouldn't exist.
Right.
And all of these kids who now are at incredibly high risk for suicide wouldn't be at high risk for suicide, but they would have a that same learning opportunity could have happened, but just in a more effective and more productive way.
Let me see. I got a bunch of comments here, an email from Nash. It's my understanding from watching the first episode that it isn't intended to be a documentary on suicide, but instead a dramatic series calling portions of the show irresponsible. Is like saying movies like The Avengers or Aliens or any other show on infidelity is irresponsible for glamorizing violence, guns, and promiscuity. I guess part of the issue is this is aimed at young people. I mean, hopefully adults can figure these things out for themselves. But any response, Guy, to what
Nash? I think it's what I said earlier. It's a complicated thing. The media glorifies violence, and no, but we don't complain about it anymore. It's sort of a fabric of the culture. Suicide's a more it is targeting more vulnerable people, and I think that's the main concern of the professional community, that there are kids out there who are going to watch this and say, I could be like that. And that's different than a war movie.
Carolina?
Yes, and I will add that the message of the show in part is that it's a normal response to bullying and trauma to kill yourself. And that's concerning. And that's a response that many of us are expressing, and especially in a context where these behaviors are so prevalent and there are so few services for these children, places to go for families that are going through these distressful situations, but also when we are seeing cuts in mental health funding that are affecting the likelihood of people being able to get services.
Yeah. The word cut or cutting has been mentioned. What do we need to understand, Matthew? How should we understand what that's about?
The idea of cutting behavior?
Yeah, cutting behavior.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of different reasons why people would engage in that type of behavior. And the important thing is, as a parent, adult, somebody who is aware of that, is to have the conversation and understand that. Because I couldn't give you six different reasons why that happened without missing 60. I often see it as sort of an ineffective way of managing internal turmoil.
It at least from the outset, feels like, why would someone hurt themselves?
Right. Yeah.
But it's what you're saying is more than that.
I think there's a lot more to it. And some people see it as, you know, they feel completely numb, and this is a way for me to feel alive, to see the blood. I know I'm still alive. So it's sort of a very convoluted way of thinking about it. But that's only a small subset of folks that feel that way. So there's a lot of different things. It's having that conversation. Help me understand this.
Yeah. Carolina.
In our work with Latinos specifically, we found that we have a clear distinction between children that do non-suicidal self-harm, that hurt themselves without suicidal intent, and kids who present suicidal behaviors with the intent to die. The big definition or the big separator is that kids who present non-suicidal self-harm want to regulate their emotions. So they are feeling very disorganized, and there are a lot of internal negative feelings. They are feeling angry, sad, upset. And cutting helps them to locate the pain somewhere where they can see it, and also soothes them. And cutters tend to be repeated cutters and very rarely transition from cutting to suicidal behaviors. It's very stable. suicidal attempters in general among Latinas report intent clearly distinctive in the sense that they want to die. They want to stop enduring what they're going through, not suit themselves. They want to end it.
They want to end it. And that's, I mean, that's an important, very stark way of understanding it. Let me just read a couple of more comments. One from Mac. I watched it. A poignant story, but does not make suicide glamorous. If anything, it reveals the pain inflicted on those left behind. We touched on this earlier. And in many ways, Guy, perhaps it is a kind of a Rorschach, which is people are going to relate to this based on their own lives and needs and fears. All of that.
I mean, I think it's one of the strategies to activate hopefulness or motivate someone to not want to hurt themselves, to have them think about the impact it'll have on others, because I think most of our kids are not looking for revenge or to punish people. They're looking to escape. So that's often a kind of cognitive strategy for, you know, think about your little sister and what it would mean to her. Oh, my God, that's right. I would never do that to her, and sort of helping a sense of responsibility about other people. I think that's how that's often thought about.
Here's an email from Kira. It says, my 19-year-old daughter has struggled with depression and severe anxiety to 4 to 5 years. She also has epilepsy, and both the condition and the medications complicate her situation. She doesn't have any real desire to go through with it, but this is very distressing for her. Does she just need to continue to cope with this, or is it possible that this could get better over time? I'm hoping that Kira's seeing people or seeing a therapist or talking. Matthew, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue for everybody is finding a life worth living for that person. And so, you know, everybody has their own vulnerabilities, and it's a matter of trying to understand, how do I utilize that as a strength for myself in some particular way? And you know, what's the meaning for me, and what's my purpose, and how do all those things relate to how I go about living my life? And you know, the challenge, I think, for kids who have been struggling for a long time with their own issues is that they haven't often had the opportunity to see the success and the joy and all those other wonderful things that can come from this, that it seems like they're looking through a lot of dark clouds, when in fact it may be that they just need some time to separate and sort those things out. Because everybody has value and everybody has purpose, right. And it's a matter of finding that for yourself.
We're almost out of time here. I see the tweet about the series, 13 Reasons Why. Their story isn't over. Season 2 is coming. Carolina, what do you hope season 2, I mean, if it's coming, what do you want them to do?
I would like to do post-intervention, which, again, as Matt said earlier, will not generate any ratings. But that's what we care about. What happens to families, schools, networks of peers who have gone through such a terrible event? How do we help them not to become suicidal? How do we help them to overcome this traumatic experience and go on to lives that are fulfilled and healthy?
And I'm assuming, Guy, it's hard to generalize when you've got millions of teenagers watching a show, but I would assume a good percentage of them would watch a show like that Carolina described, which is, how do we deal with this?
Yeah, I think a lot of kids would welcome the opportunity to watch families struggle with things, watch parents confront some of their own limitations and learn how to be more available, watch kids learn how to talk about something like rape and report it and struggle with the social challenges of that. You know, I think those can be as entertaining as, you know, just the kind of drama and avoidance and sensationalism.
Yeah, we're a bunch of mental health professionals here, though. So, I mean, it's, you know, we have to be a little bit realistic about it.
Teenagers are,
they do need to see the positive that can come from all this. I mean, it's sort of, you know, at the end of episode 13, you're left with just a mess. And you know, finding some resolution to that in a helpful, effective way, I think, would be terribly valuable. And I think they could do it. I think they could do it. I hope that they have heard what lots of people have been saying, and maybe we'll take that direction.
Well, stay tuned. My thanks to all three of you for coming in and talking about such an important issue. Matthew Winterstein and Carolina Hausman-Stabile and Guy Diamond talking about teenagers and suicide and this Netflix series, 13 Reasons Why. Go to WHYY.com. www.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show. We did take some pictures of our guests. You can check them out as well. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Stop. Before you consider taking drastic measures to lose weight, like GLP-1 injections, consider Golo. Golo's release is easier than injections and fad diets. No need to jump through insurance hoops. It's simple. You take one release supplement with each meal. Golo's release supplement contains 7 natural plants and 3 key minerals that target body fat and combat the stress of dieting. With Golo, you follow the Golo for Life plan, where you'll safely and effectively control sugar cravings and hunger while minimizing muscle loss, allowing you to feel good and inspired to reach your goal weight. With Golo, you get an effective and affordable weight loss solution that's clinically proven, because controlling glucose, maintaining healthy insulin levels, and saying goodbye to starvation dieting is the secret to lasting weight loss and wellness. Visit Golo.com to get started today. That's Golo.com. Go to Golo.com to join the 5 million people who have switched to Golo as a better way to lose weight. Visit Golo.com today.